But as he becomes increasingly obsessed with Twitter, as he starts building brain-computer interfaces, as he starts becoming more and more engaged with both the possibilities and the potential existential risks of artificial intelligence, really comes to believe that humanity is increasingly being integrated and in fact even disappearing into our technologies, and that this is a evolutionary development, if you like, that should be welcomed, and that he, as an entrepreneur, can help accelerate.
Hi, I'm Matt Ho, a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Institute, and this month I am guest hosting Deep Focus. Tech billionaire Elon Musk's SpaceX is public at a projected valuation of $1.8 trillion. It will be the largest initial public offering in history. It's expected to raise between $75 and $80 billion, which will make it the sixth or seventh largest company in the world overnight. That, at least on paper, could make Elon Musk the world's first trillionaire. The offering will raise capital to fund operations and next-generation research and development for the space rocket company, as well as expand the company's AI infrastructure and increase its Starlink broadband services. Of course, the IPO will provide enormous liquidity, or payouts, for longtime employees and early private investors. The authors of a new book, Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed, however, argue this IPO comes as stock market indices change their rules to fast-track SpaceX stock into people's pension funds. Research shows the company doesn't make enough money to justify a valuation that is 50 times its current value, and the company's future and its stock price rests on untested and non-existent technologies such as data centers and space. Joining me today are Quinn Slobodian and Ben Tarnoff, co-authors of Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed. Professor Slobodian is a professor of international history at Boston University and the author of several books, including Globalists, Crack Up Capitalism, and Hayek's Bastards, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. Ben Tarnoff is a writer and technologist based in Massachusetts and is the author of Internet for the People and the co-author of Voices from the Valley, Tech Workers Talk About What They Do and How They Do It. He is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and has also written for the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the New Republic, among other publications. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with why you both decided to look at Elon Musk and his companies. As I was saying to you before, this is so fascinating to me. You know, it's not just the cult of personality. It's this incredible change in how our economy functions, how our society functions, how our government is going to function. So let's just start with why you decided to look into Elon Musk. How did you get interested in him? And, you know, as well as, too, then the book itself, if you can explain how it's just not biographical, but it places Elon Musk, you know, as this catalyst, you know, for this change in our government and society.
Well, I'd say our starting point for thinking about this book project was actually looking at a figure who Musk is often compared to, Henry Ford. Henry Ford was, of course, a famous industrialist who transformed how cars were produced. But he was also someone who lent his name to a concept called Fordism that observers of various kinds in the last century used to describe a kind of capitalism that they saw coming into view in the middle of the 20th century, that they defined broadly as a combination of mass production and mass consumption. So it wasn't just about how Ford changed the way cars were made, but it was also about looking at Ford's life and work and extrapolating the materials of a broader social system. What kind of world did you have to organize to be conducive with the needs of mass production? That was kind of our methodology in looking at Musk. Obviously, he's a wildly successful entrepreneur. He's on track to be the first trillionaire, as you mentioned in your opening remarks. But our interest in Musk was a bit different, where we wanted to step back from Musk the man and ask the question, could we look at Musk as an avatar for a particular stage of capitalism in a way comparable to how theorists of the last century looked at Ford and thought about him as an avatar of something called Fordism?
And so for us, I think it was less coming to a conclusion that would be definitive, that we would say, okay, Muskism exists just as Fordism exists, and more a way to ask different questions than the questions that have been asked. So we actually started writing the book because we both reviewed the Isaacson biography of Musk, which you may have read, a lot of people did. But it was really a kind of psychological portrait of Musk, right? The intention of the biographer was that by excavating his childhood and his like various travails through his early career, you could understand the secret sauce of what made Musk into the kind of world-making genius he became. For us, he was more interesting as a kind of industrialist who is changing the nature of production, changing the nature of reliance on global supply chain, so emphasizing vertical integration, deglobalizing before it was cool, and also in some ways failing to deliver the kind of thing that Ford had done in the past. So Fordism, when people talk about it, was also a kind of social contract, right? It was a deal with the working class. It was a deal that said, you come and allow yourself to be worked to the bone in my factory, and I'm going to give you a part of the profits through collective bargaining agreements. I'm going to give you cradle to the grave social protections through the company. I'm going to give you something like lifetime employment. I'm going to reinforce the male breadwinner headed nuclear family and kind of anchor social relations in this conservative way. And because of the organized nature of the working class in the mid-century, they were able to push those demands and get them fulfilled by the employer. Our interest really throughout the book, and even more by the end, I think, is like, where does Musk come down on that? What's his offer? What's his version of a social contract? How does he expect all of us to go along with his, you know, often madcap seeming schemes? And there, you know, we start getting into the financial entanglements that you mentioned at the top, that then becomes the way that we get brought in, even without our consent in some ways, into his new modes of making money and making, you know, new forms of society.
Right. And we're definitely going to get into that, yeah, about how we're all affected by Muskism, mm-hmm, just mm-hmm, as I think your articulation there, mm-hmm, of Fordism and the effects it had throughout the 20th century. I mean, essentially, we're looking at the same thing with Muskism in the 21st century and mm-hmm, how it will affect all of us. But I want to go back as I think about the first times I heard about Elon Musk more than 20 years ago. He was an early internet star, if you will, in terms of his success with his early companies. And then, of course, he comes out with these little electric roadsters. And the comparison I remember maybe at the time was comparisons to Edison, right? And it's these ideas of this bright-eyed optimist visionary who's going to take us into the future. And so maybe if you could pick up from around then, about 2006 or so, when I first saw these little electric Tesla roadsters at the dealership in Washington, D.C., and thought they were kind of neat. If you guys could take it up from there, explain his evolution, as well as, too, if you could address what the companies are like, because there is almost like a Russian doll aspect to Elon Musk's corporations here, in that they are folded on in upon themselves. And that himself is, of course, not only interesting, but problematic.
Well, in the 1990s, Musk makes his first fortune as a dot-com entrepreneur. So he cashes out of the dot-com boom at just the right time. And he takes his money and he does something rather unusual with it. This is a moment when his peers and colleagues are kind of crawling out of the wreckage of the dot-com bust and thinking about laying the groundwork of what will be called Web 2.0, or kind of the platform era. They're basically making websites and apps of different kinds. Musk moves to Southern California and starts a rocket company, SpaceX, in 2002. And then becomes the lead investor and eventually CEO of Tesla in 2008. So he's not making websites and apps. He's doing the tough, heavy physics of rockets and cars. And in both cases, however, the state plays a very important role in facilitating his efforts. And this is an important argument of our book, which is to say that Musk is not and has never been a libertarian. He's always someone who has sought out a lucrative interaction with governments, a dynamic that we call state symbiosis. And in the case of Tesla, that is particularly apparent. So Tesla belonged to a ecosystem of startups that were known as clean tech startups. There was a lot of enthusiasm in the 2000s in Silicon Valley about getting into technologies of the energy transition. There was even a thought that this would be a lucrative frontier comparable to the one that the internet represented. Tesla belongs to this broader movement. And for these folks, Obama and the election of Obama in 2008 is really hailed as the breakthrough moment, because Obama comes into office promising a significant public investment in the renewable transition, which he believes will finally achieve the goal of American energy independence, which will have the added benefit, in his view, of reducing the country's appetite for foreign adventurism, like the Iraq War. So in 2009, Obama's Department of Energy awards Tesla nearly $500 million loan, which is widely understood to be a life-saving loan. The president of Tesla at the time says that the company probably wouldn't have survived without it. So in retrospect, we can see Tesla as a creature of green industrial policy, not unlike the sort of stuff that Biden was attempting to do with the Inflation Reduction Act during his term, and a successful one. You know, it's interesting because at the time, Republicans are very critical of this green industrial policy. If you recall, Solyndra became a kind of term of abuse. This was a company making solar cells that went bust. And when Republicans retake Congress, really hammer Obama for investing in Solyndra. But, you know, I think Quinn and I are making a more sympathetic case here, which is that we don't see Tesla in this case to be a parasite or an example of crony capitalism. We actually think it's an example of good industrial policy. Now, Tesla over time, and particularly recently, has actually migrated away from understanding itself to be a car company. It's now positioned much more as an AI and robotics company, which shows you how Musk is always keenly trying to position himself for the next kind of political economic paradigm. But I think there's plenty in this history that can be recuperated for progressive ends.
I think it's also important to clarify something that I think is often misunderstood about Musk's trajectory. So you're exactly right, Matt, that around the 2008-09 moment, he had a kind of mystique that was in a different category than people like, I don't know, Larry Page, Mark Zuckerberg, right? Because he seemed to be interested in making things. His cameo in Iron Man 2, I think, is basically him saying to Tony Stark, I want to tell you my plans about building an electric plane, right? And then he moves off. So that was, I think, for good reason, a reason that people were kind of like, this guy's kind of quirky. And also, he doesn't seem so wrapped up in that internet thing like everyone else in Silicon Valley. He's actually like doing 20th century industrialism, but updating it for an electric age. But I think one of the things, arguments we're trying to make in the book is that if you look a little closer, the internet was kind of always there. So if you look at Musk's development from his time in South Africa onward, you know, the big breakthrough moment for him is when he gets this programmable Commodore personal computer that he can, you know, write programs himself, he can run it. Soon afterwards, he gets his first modem uplink and he's speaking to, you know, Oxford University from Pretoria. He gets very excited about this idea that the computer can be a kind of control unit for the economy and for society in a way that it never had been before. When he gets to Silicon Valley, he reinforces that understanding. The second chapter of our book is called The Superset because of this great moment when Musk is doing an interview as exactly the sort of fresh-faced ingenue of the dot-com scene in the late 90s. And he says, the internet is becoming the superset of all media. Eventually, everything's going to be folded into it. Banking, communication, television, radio, sports, everything's going to happen online. And people are kind of nodding like, okay, sure. And his PayPal venture seemed to validate that. But then, as Ben said, to many people, it looked like he took a hard turn away from the ephemerality of the internet and started doing hard physical things, rockets and cars. But if you look at the market that he was plugging into for rockets and cars, they're closely related to the idea of network technologies. So this, you know, you as a foreign policy guy and former serviceman will know about the idea of the network-centric battlefield that was a core part of the Rumsfeld Doctrine. It was about reducing large land armies, rolling out mobile special forces, satellite-guided munitions, and it needed satellites. So that was what Musk made his first entry into his role as a direct government contractor with SpaceX, was to say, I'll help you put those satellites up more cheaply than the incumbents or the legacy service providers. So there, yes, it's about rockets, but it's actually also about network technologies. Same thing with Tesla. What makes Tesla's name in the industry and makes investors really interested is the fact that he turns the electric vehicle not just into something that's run on lithium-ion batteries instead of fossil fuels, but it becomes a node in an internet network, right? You can get over-the-air updates, and your Tesla will, you know, get an update overnight, and it will have different capabilities than what it did before. So from that very early moment, he was always saying, you know, the Tesla is actually a laptop on wheels. The Tesla is actually a robot on wheels. So he's always had this kind of, you know, network cyborg internet through line, even when it seemed like he was, you know, an ordinary updated industrialist.
Right. I think that's confused a lot of people, yeah. Right? This idea of what the heck do cars have to do with rocket ships?
Right.
Right. And then you get even into the next aspect of mm-hmm. his empire, mm-hmm. if you will. And I also want to ask you guys about this idea of him being a techno king.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, you can get into his other businesses. You know, how do you, and particularly, how does he acquire them? Because I think that is so instructive in terms of how these are paid for, if you will. And that gets to this larger issue of the financial aspects that, again, are going to affect many of us, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get to the government aspects as well, which is going to affect all of us. But this idea with, you know, with XAI and with Twitter that they make him X, how does this all work together? How is this Muskism, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, I think, for many people, this transition from Musk, the hardware guy, to Musk, the software guy. And as Quinn is pointing out, if you look more closely at SpaceX and Tesla, they were always already software companies too. I think that distinction is in fact a false one. But in the popular perception, you know, Musk was the kind of Iron Man guy who was like making stuff, and that I think really helped him maintain his reputation relative to other Silicon Valley figures, particularly as the techlash gets rolling in 2016. You think about the reputational fortunes of someone like Mark Zuckerberg compared to Musk. Musk really maintains his status because he's someone who makes things. But then there is, of course, the acquisition of Twitter and its transformation into X. There is XAI, which he starts in 2023. And we might also add, although this is a bit earlier, Neuralink, which he founds in the mid-2010s, which often is de-emphasized in the Musk conversation. We really make the case in the book that Neuralink is very, very important for Musk because, so for folks who don't know, Neuralink manufactures what are known as brain-computer interfaces. And what this means is that you can, particularly people with disabilities, people who have had accidents, can have a device implanted such that they can control a computer through their thoughts, that the device essentially interprets the electrical signals that their brain is generating and translates that into instructions for the computer. Now, Neuralink is not the first to develop this technology. It's been around for a while. What distinguishes Neuralink and what makes it, I think, so important for Musk's worldview, especially at present, is that he sees it as a technology that's not just for people with disabilities, but as potentially a mass market commodity. He imagines a future in which millions, even billions of people around the world have a Neuralink implanted in their brain. And the reason that he thinks this is a desirable future is because he sees it as one of the best ways that we can accelerate the integration of human beings with our machines, to increase the flow, and for him, crucially, a two-way flow of information between us and our networked technologies. And I think this really holds the key to the last, let's say, decade or so of Musk and Muskism, what we describe as his cyborg turn. He has long been fascinated with computers, the internet, as Quinn mentioned. That was a fascination that originated in his childhood in South Africa, deepens during his experience in Silicon Valley in the 1990s. But as he becomes increasingly obsessed with Twitter, as he starts building brain-computer interfaces, as he starts becoming more and more engaged with both the possibilities and the potential existential risks of artificial intelligence, really comes to believe that humanity is increasingly being integrated and in fact even disappearing into our technologies, and that this is a evolutionary development, if you like, that should be welcomed and that he as an entrepreneur can help accelerate.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the present moment is how it's making the kind of synthesis of these different strands of his business empire more explicit, right? So as recently as last year, you know, you could make the arguments that Ben and I did in the book, and I think they're still correct, that, you know, he starts OpenAI with Altman in 2016, and then shortly afterward, 2015, and shortly thereafterward founds Neuralink, because he sees the solution to AI as not, you know, slowing down development, stopping it, but actually accelerating integration with machines in the way that Ben is describing, so that the human machine symbiote, as he calls it, will be advanced enough to get out ahead of a malevolent digital superintelligence. With the rollout of ChatGPT in late 2022, the story of generative AI takes over Silicon Valley, and he gets very concerned that OpenAI and Anthropic have developed what he thinks of as woke AI models, and Google Gemini too, that have been infected by the progressive politics of the Biden years. And so he needs to create, in his own narration, XAI as a kind of anti-woke alternative that will be, quote, maximally truth-seeking, meaning downplaying all kinds of claims for, you know, progressive redress or anti-racism and anti-sexism and so on. So until 2026, you had these things existing in isolation. What's happened, you know, for those people who haven't been tracking this closely, is quite dramatic since the beginning of this year, which is XAI formally purchased X.com, the social media platform. And shortly after that, SpaceX formally purchased and merged with XAI. So now what is going public is a conglomerate ensemble of services and products that include in their description a connectivity segment, which is the satellites, a space segment, which is the rockets, and then an AI segment, by which he means XAI, but also X.com. These things are all described as working in complementarity with each other, because why he needs the money is to put orbital AI data centers in space. The unique advantage, as he sees it, of XAI is not only that we'll have access to this great new computer power that's unlocked by unlimited solar energy, but also the real-time news and discourse that is coming in through his social media platform that will keep Grok, the chatbot, much more abreast, apparently, of, you know, the changing landscape of events than his competitors. So that's seen as a what he calls a vertically integrated innovation engine, which is also a kind of push for a global telecommunications monopoly, because the only profitable part of the business right now is the Starlink internet business, which has over 10 million subscribers and growing. And the proposal is those Starlink satellites will now not just provide broadband, but will also provide cellular service at some point in the future, you know, granted all kinds of engineering and regulatory hurdles being cleared. So they are all now entering into a kind of interconnected ensemble. And the odds makers now say that the likelihood of Tesla becoming part of that are better than 50%, which means that, as Ben mentioned, this claim that Tesla is now an AI and robotics company will be integrated into the kind of bundle of enterprises that SpaceX has become. And all of this is, it should be noted, very unusual in modern American capitalism, right? I mean, this is the creation of a conglomerate out of diverse, formerly very different business models, and in an attempt to produce a monopoly, which in sort of traditional ways of thinking in American capitalism would be something that the government would have an incentive to prevent emerging. But the environment we're in now is actually paving the way for Musk's attempts at achieving monopoly.
Right. And that monopoly would essentially be a closed media system.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
With him as, again, the techno king.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get into to that, those societal and then government aspects, I want to address, though, this IPO that you just mentioned again. So this public offering, one of the largest in history, the largest in history. It may or may not make him the world's first trillionaire. Why should somebody who's not involved in this care? Right. If you're not somebody who's going to buy SpaceX stock, why should you care about this? And what are the broader implications for how this IPO is going forward, including how it's rigged? It's crooked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one very concrete consequence that will have is for anyone whose retirement accounts tracks the NASDAQ 100 index, SpaceX will soon be included in that index. And that means that, you know, your retirement prospects will be wrapped up with the financial fortunes of SpaceX, which is pretty extraordinary.
And just to point out to people, normally it takes more than a year for a company to make its way into index funds, correct?
Yeah. So they revised the rules for the index in order to enable SpaceX and, you know, if Anthropic and OpenAI IPO this year, as has been expected, it would also open the index to those entrants as well. Interestingly, the S&P 500, which is another big index that one hears about, declined to revise the rules, but NASDAQ did. So what this means is, you know, it's a very popular index. And if you or your retirement account, your 401k, your pension funds are invested in this, you are connected to Musk and his fortunes. I mean, more broadly, just its presence as, you know, one of the largest corporations in the world in the stock market will make Musk financially even more significant than he already is. I mean, his firms, both SpaceX and Tesla, which has been publicly traded for a while, will really have the power to move markets in ways that, you know, can affect millions of people's lives. More broadly, however, this is also an opportunity for Musk to finance his AI ambitions. I mean, arguably the reason he's going public now is because he wants to access capital markets, because he understands himself to be somewhat of a laggard in the AI race. Grok is nowhere near as popular as Claude, Gemini, or ChatGPT. Developing Grok at any large language model is very expensive. And Musk sees an opportunity here to get a lot of investor cash to fund what he really sees as the future of his empire. I mean, if you read the prospectus for the SpaceX IPO that they filed with the SEC, they really see their future as an AI company. And the way this has been kind of materially expressed is in this vision of orbital data centers, the notion that you can put up a network of small satellites that will use the energy from the sun to power the training and the deployment of large language models, thus breaking the bottleneck of energy on Earth, which is already slowing down data center construction and has become an impediment for the hyperscalers as they try to build out their AI capabilities.
I think there's also a few things that have alarmed people who have been observing the rollout of the IPO and the conditions under which it's going to happen. You know, as Ben says, the pushing of SpaceX or the adoption of SpaceX by NASDAQ means that over time, people's financial futures will be wound up in SpaceX's financial futures. But there's also a couple of other elements that have raised some eyebrows. One is the fact that Musk has set aside 30% of those shares for retail investors, meaning he's very much betting on the kind of hype cycle that he's so good at producing, at least pumping up the value of SpaceX soon after IPO. The reason why NASDAQ and S&P 500 have those longer wait periods, so-called seasoning periods, is to like let the market kind of find its natural level at some to some degree, right? To avoid capturing everyday passive index fund investors in a boom and bust cycle that might go very wrong, as it did with, for example, the WeWork IPO a few years ago. By setting it up this way, it means that people who already have equity who gets turned into shares can sell it very quickly at its peak. And then those retail investors can, as they say, be left holding the bag. That's at least one of the justified concerns here, that this is a way to transfer a huge amount of money into the pockets of insiders and then kind of leave the rest of people in the lurch. A second aspect that is really notable is the way that Musk has redesigned corporate governance in the case of SpaceX, which is that he has 85% of the shares which are required to remove him from the position as CEO, chairman of the board, and CTO. So he cannot be dislodged. So the usual forms of accountability that the leader of a publicly traded company has to its shareholders have been deliberately blocked and short-circuited by the move from Delaware to Texas, by the way that the share structure has been designed, so that even if people don't like the way Musk is governing the company, there's no way for them to do anything about it. Even the question of his death is not addressed in the prospectus, amazingly. There's no deputy, there's no successor plan. He will simply be, you know, the key person will be removed, and then the shares that have the votes attached to them will be given to one of his heirs, who will then have the ability to appoint the new head of one of the world's biggest companies. So there's all of that fear. And then as Ben says, because Tesla and SpaceX now will be, you know, among the top traded companies in the United States, the likelihood of a government bailout, should they begin to falter, is almost guaranteed, right? So by making himself too big to fail for the U.S. economy at large, he basically locks in a backstop with the U.S. government, which over time has been more than willing to prostrate themselves with unconditional bailouts for corporate leaders, right? This is one way in which the U.S. and China is very different, by the way, is the U.S. will tend to always subordinate itself to its primary value creators in ways that other countries won't. So all of those things, I think, mean that this is not just a question of buying or not buying SpaceX IPO. A, if you're in the index funds, you're going to be buying him sooner or later. And B, the keystone role that he's going to play in the financial economy of the United States is one that makes him a load-bearing pillar for a lot of other things that are around and on top of it.
Right. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, the danger here, you know, your mom is a retired public school teacher. Her pension fund is invested heavily with these index funds, particularly NASDAQ 100. That is now going to be dependent in some way, shape, or form on the success of these data centers in space, as well as all the other dangers of the AI bubbles. You know, we've seen reports from foreign investors not wanting to put as much money into the American economy.
Absolutely.
Because of, among other things, the AI bubble or the perceived AI bubble. So, you know, this is, a, you know, but I want to go back to Ben, what you mentioned earlier, symbiosis, because you guys just did a really great job explaining financially how this is affecting people, whether they like it or not. But now, you know, you may say, I got no involvement in the market. I don't have a retirement fund. I got nothing to do with me. This isn't going to bother me. But can you get Ben, can you get, and Quinn, can you get into this idea of state symbiosis and where Muskism is in terms of reshaping our government?
Well, I think Quinn earlier mentioned briefly that SpaceX gets its start as a government contractor in the first full year of the War on Terror. And it does so in particular by promising to put smaller, cheaper, more rapidly deployable satellites up into orbit to support U.S. military operations that are increasingly attempting to rely on high technology. SpaceX, over the next 20 years, achieves a more than 90% reduction in the cost of putting mass into orbit. So it makes it possible for the Pentagon and for intelligence services to have vastly more space assets than they could have imagined before. And this is important to emphasize because when we talk about state symbiosis, it's a relationship of mutual benefit. Just as we're saying that Musk is not a libertarian, we're also not trying to describe him as a crony capitalist, as someone who is simply a parasite on the state and drawing subsidy from public coffers, offering nothing in return. If you are a battlefield commander, if you are someone at the CIA, you have expanded capacity. Arguably, the United States has expanded powers of sovereignty that didn't exist before, precisely because Musk transformed the economics of orbital launch. So he derives an advantage, of course, because he becomes the monopoly private provider of that service. He essentially controls the U.S. orbital launch market single-handedly, and at this point, more than half of the global launch market. So obviously, Musk is deriving an advantage here. But the state, at least in certain capacities, particularly related to war making, is also deriving an advantage. And this is an important distinction for us because I think it takes us a little bit further from what is sometimes described as the neoliberal era, where the emphasis is on states losing their capacity, on the dilution of sovereignty. We sometimes describe Muskism as the increase of state capacity, albeit through private means. So it's not independent state capacity. It's state capacity that functions as sovereignty as a service, where the state has to purchase the ability to exercise its sovereignty from a monopoly private provider, not unlike the kind of subscription services that we have as consumers to Netflix or the Google Suite or whatever. Now it's the Pentagon paying a subscription service to be able to conduct military operations. So there are new vulnerabilities, there are new geopolitical costs, but there are also expanded capacities and opportunities here.
Right. I mean, you certainly had this issue with the Pentagon last year, where the Congress, through the NDAA last year, the National Defense Authorization Act, prohibited the Pentagon from essentially outlawing the ability of corporations to dictate how the Pentagon can do maintenance on the weapons platforms the Pentagon purchased. Essentially, this right to repair. You know, and so I think many people will be listening to you guys and saying, that's nothing. You guys are just talking about basic outsourcing, but it's not. It's, as you said, this principle of corporate sovereignty to which the government has to subscribe. Is that right?
I mean, it's helpful to look, I think, at something like DOGE to see this in action, right? I mean, people from the outside saw that as just a kind of politically motivated, destructive act of almost vandalism across state agencies, you know, carrying out kind of culture war aims through attacks on supposedly useless forms of research and aid and welfare provision. But another way of looking at the way we frame it in the book is kind of him trying to create state X. So what's he doing? He's also kind of clearing out agencies and making them able to speak to each other more, make them more compatible and more reliant in the final instance on the very kind of AI and database software that he and people like Alexander Karp of Palantir and Dario Amodei of Anthropic are then the only people who are able to provide, right? So deepening that level of dependency is arguably the kind of proactive version of doing this tech attack on the traditional state. One of the ironies is that Musk and Palantir and others got into this business to displace the old primes and the old traditional legacy military contractors. But now it's gone so far that the military itself is starting to worry about the commercial dominance of a single provider, namely Musk. And in fact, it's from what I read, it's now become a kind of Department of War mandate to diversify suppliers to make sure that they too are not completely reliant on Musk's provisions and services. So that's an interesting tipping point in that symbiotic relationship. And I think one of our arguments in the book is that it needs to be constantly tended and renegotiated. It's rarely stable, right? I mean, the Anthropic feud with the Department of War is a great example of that, where contractual obligations mean one thing, but if you just decide to pull your services, then it's hard to enforce when they're the only game in town. So I think, you know, it's a three-way story, though. And I think to return us back to the beginning of our conversation, when we were talking about Fordism, we were talking mostly about the relationship between the boss and the workers, right? The social contract was, in a way, the nexus that needed to be figured out to make the profit model work. We've, over the course of this conversation, started talking more about the corporation and the state as if that is the only sort of relationship that needs to be worked out. What gets left out then is the people. And as consumers, as employees, as people who can, you know, fabricate the products that people like Musk are selling to the general public. And that seems to be actually a crucial oversight on the part of people like Musk, because they have actually failed to attend to the social contract in a way that, in ideal typical terms, Fordism was very good at attending to.
Right.
And he's actually tried to either sow hate mongering and a sort of ethos of social war to an extent that he's proposing basically a negative social contract. You're either with me or you're on the side of the evil immigrants and the criminals. Or he's made a kind of unconvincing promise that, trust me, and we'll all have, you know, 1 hour work weeks in the coming future in my world of amazing abundance. But the lack of attention to the social contract in the end is one of the most glaring things that comes out from this comparison between the Muskism we have now and the Fordism that once existed.
This is all just so fascinating. And you know, I'm sitting here thinking that my political philosophy professor in college, you know, Professor Devine, should incorporate this book into, you know, Rousseau and Hobbes and Locke, right? I mean, because what you guys are getting out here is this fundamental relationship in society,
yeah,
between citizens, their government, corporations, and workers, and then this nexus that exists between them, mm-hmm, in a way that go back to Ford. And I just love how you guys, you know, equate this to Ford, or at least compare this to Fordism, mm-hmm, in a way that was inconceivable at that time, not just because of the technology, but because of the social contract.
Right.
But, you know, the next thing to get into here, though, is the politics. And we can't talk about Elon Musk, whether it's his purchase of X and his reasons for it, or just what he envisions, without talking about his politics and his involvement, particularly in far-right politics. You know, we saw the dalliance there with the Trump administration. You know, a year ago, they had their big breakup. I don't know what the status of that relationship is now, but certainly I don't think Elon Musk has moved away from his interest in politics. So if you all want to, you know, get into this a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say there is that the feud has been mended, right? I mean, they were on the plane together to China. Musk has closed over $7 billion of new contracts with the state through the investments in the so-called Golden Dome missile defense project. So SpaceX has closed those already in just this year. But notable, and someone just put up those stats today online, in the last week, ahead of the biggest IPO in history, Musk has actually posted more on X about the race riots in the UK than he has about his own $1.75 wow. trillion dollar company, right?
Wow.
So like, put that in your pipe and smoke it, right? I mean, how is that rational business behavior? Right. How does that help to solve this problem of the missing social contract? It seems reckless. It seems self-destructive and self-undermining. But if there's anything we've learned about Musk, is things that seem destructive to his own bottom line end up somehow, through acrobatics and judo moves, to profit his bottom line. And they seem to never cause the line to go down at any point, right? This is his real rhetorical agility. So that would, I mean, that would be my kind of observation about the way that politics continues to act as his ersatz for some kind of real offer to people, is this idea that you can meme your way out of any problem.
Right, right. And unfortunately, gentlemen, we're getting short on time here. We really just have time for one more question, although I have like about 1,000 others. The book, again, is Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed. I certainly was perplexed before. After these last 45 minutes, I don't think perplexed is the word. It's intrigued. I mean, this, again, the way you all break this down and put this on the different levels here is just fascinating. And it's not hyperbole to the conceit of your book, how Muskism is a prime driver in our society at all levels. But the last question, gentlemen, is Muskism possible without Musk? You alluded to before, there's no secession plan. Is it possible without him? What happens if, you know, he is not here tomorrow for whatever reason? And then what comes out of this? Is there a path that you see forward where this, do we descend into the techno-feudalism with, you know, techno kings, as you will? Just your thoughts on this idea of Musk and Muskism, and is it possible without Musk?
Well, I think our answer is yes, Muskism is absolutely possible without Musk, but it's also not inevitable. We're not trying to be excessively pessimistic about what the near future holds. When you think about Muskism and in the modules of Muskism that we map out in the book, state symbiosis is something we've been talking a lot about in this conversation. Also, the embrace of a more deglobalized, vertically integrated production model, this extreme reliance on financial markets, especially as mediated through social media and memes that move markets, a dynamic that we describe in the book as financial fabulism. When you take all these ingredients of Muskism and look out in the world, there are a number of other individuals, even some in Musk's own milieu, who embody many of these same themes. If you think about Alexander Karp, the head of Palantir, and his recently published co-authored book, The Technological Republic, it actually expresses many of the themes that we discuss in the book in a tribute to Muskism. So if Musk were to disappear from the stage tomorrow, there are no shortage of Muskists out there who would continue to propagate this worldview. However, and this is perhaps where a hopeful note enters the conversation, there's nothing inevitable about that future. As Quinn pointed out, the social contract of Muskism is weak to non-existent. It doesn't really account for the problem of popular consent, of people having independent political judgment that needs to be reasoned with in order to secure legitimacy. That's not something Muskism is particularly concerned with. And as we're seeing now with this enormous popular backlash to data centers, you know, AI is likely actually to be a major issue in the upcoming midterms. That can be a real liability, not just for Musk, but for the Silicon Valley leadership class as a whole. That's not really something they counted on. And I think progressive forces can make use of that mobilization to direct that energy toward productive ends and hopefully begin to weaken the power of the tech oligarchy.
Right, right. And Quinn, last thoughts there?
I would just endorse that. I mean, there is a pedagogical value of the fact that Musk bolted together all of these modules, as Ben was describing, into this one figure of the mech that we sometimes conjure up in the book, a figure that was very inspiring to him from 1980s Japanese anime, right? A kind of man-machine fusion of a humanoid robot. The good thing about that mech is you see it coming and you're like, holy, it's impossible not to notice, right? And that's what's happened with Musk and tech dominance across the EU, across China, across India, South Africa, Brazil. The very heterogeneity of his ambitions and the willfully polarizing nature of his rhetoric has made it impossible not to reckon with him, right? So it's accelerated efforts at delinking from American technology like nothing else had managed to do in the past, right? It's because of the specter of Musk now that the EU is talking nonstop about tech sovereignty, how to replace Starlink, how to replace SpaceX. If he hadn't been quite as monstrous as he has been, and I would say that agreeing with the call for a Reconquista or the expulsion of Muslims from Europe, as he said in a tweet just this week, is monstrous. If he hadn't been quite that monstrous, then maybe he could have been quietly kept his accumulation engine going indefinitely. But because he chose to kind of overreach in certain ways in his hubris, he's now made, I think, a reckoning unavoidable. And this is, you know, probably overall good for people who would love to see a different world.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I could talk to you about this all day. The book is Muskism, A Guide to the Perplexed. It is not just a biography of Elon Musk, but it's an analysis of where we're going as a society. I mean, the work here you guys are doing is just absolutely incredible. The book's available now.
Thank you so much.
I assume people can buy it from wherever they want to buy it from. I would urge you to buy it from your local bookstore, not from the another guy who's also a techno king. But
he also likes
rockets. Yeah, but certainly, this conversation has just really just, I think, touched the tip of what you are getting out here. So I encourage people to get this book. And again, because it's not just a biography of Elon Musk. It is really getting to core aspects of our society and where we're heading towards. So again, the book is Muskism, a Guide for the Perplexed. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. I want to thank Professor Quinn Sabodian and Ben Tarnoff, the co-authors of Muskism. I'm Matt Ho, a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Media Network. I'll be guest hosting Deep Focus for the rest of the month. Please like, share, and comment on this episode, and continue to join us as we bring you deep discussions on topics of the day. Thank you for watching and listening.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.